The sun did not shine. It was too wet to play. Just sit in the house all that cold, cold, wet day.
That's the beginning of a classic children's book by Dr. Seuss.
Just sit in the house. Just sit there and grump. Then, all of a sudden, something went bump.
Look! A cat in a hat!
Yep, The Cat in the Hat. A story about two kids stuck at home on a rainy day, visited by a mischievous feline in a hat who keeps them entertained and gets them in a lot of trouble. If it's been a while, you may remember a few scattered details, but does anything jump out to you as possibly racist? I'm Gina Kaufman, and now we're going to talk to a K-State professor who's written a new book. Was The Cat in the Hat Black? The Hidden Racism of Children's Literature. Philip Nell, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Thank you.
So help me with this Cat in the Hat thing. My recollection of this story is admittedly vague.
Well, sure. So to answer the question, is he racist? He's racially complicated. He is influenced by blackface minstrelsy, which is not unusual in children's culture. Mickey Mouse, Bugs Bunny, the Cat in the Hat, they all have white gloves. They are all outlandish. In the case of the Cat in the Hat, he has a crazy fashion sense, which ties him to minstrel characters as well. And of course, he is a black cat in a white family's home who is creating chaos. But he's also influenced by an actual person of color, a woman named Annie Williams, who, when Dr. Seuss was asked by the education director of Houghton Mifflin to write him a book that first graders couldn't put down, he came up with The Cat in the Hat, and he gave The Cat in the Hat the color and the white gloves of Mrs. Williams, who was an elevator operator at Houghton Mifflin, who, as I say, had white gloves and a secret smile. So he's a racially complicated character, is the short answer to that question. He's interesting to me because Seuss did both racist and anti-racist work and was doing it at the same time, and the cat embodies that contradiction.
So when you talk about the influence of minstrel traditions on many children's book and animation characters, what do you think that's about?
Well, I think it's about the way that racial caricature circulates in children's culture, often in ways that we're not aware. And the import of that is that that's also how racism works, that we learn it, but we're often not aware that we're learning it. And we might learn it in ways that are quite overt, and we might learn it in ways that are quite subtle. And this would fall into the more subtle category. A more overt example would be, I remember a few years ago, I was preparing to teach a graduate class in which I was going to teach Little Black Sambo, because I wanted to talk about racism in children's literature. And so I read the book for the first time, except that it wasn't the first time. I had already read it, although I have no idea when. And
you just recognized certain phrases and things that told you, I've heard this before, I've seen this before?
I knew the story. I knew the story of the boy who tricked the tigers and ate the pancakes at the end. I already knew it, but I didn't remember when I'd encountered it or what version I'd read, or if the version I'd read had more grotesque racist caricature than the one that I was teaching. But that's the way that culture works. We absorb its messages on an unconscious level, and it influences us whether we're aware of it or not. And that's also, of course, how racism works. If you grow up in a racist culture, it influences you even if you are not consciously aware of that.
So talk to me. I want to get back to The Cat in the Hat, even though I realize that that you're exploring more than The Cat in the Hat in your book.
Yeah.
I'm kind of fascinated by this idea that there was a real character who inspired the Cat in the Hat character. Could you tell us more about this woman in real life? What do we know about her?
You know, I don't know too much about her in real life. I really know what I told you, that she had a sly smile, wore white gloves, and that she was in the elevator as Seuss was dreaming up the idea of the Cat in the Hat. The Cat in the Hat is also influenced by Crazy Cat, who is the ambiguously gendered creation of biracial cartoonist George Harriman. The Cat in the Hat bears the traces of the Cheshire Cat. He has a lot of influences beyond blackface minstrelsy. But in children's literature, animals have long been used to talk about race, both from an anti-racist perspective and from a racist perspective. Animals have been used to represent similarities between or differences among different kinds of people. So he is a racialized figure in children's literature, and an ambiguously racialized figure, I would say, too. I mean, he bears the traces of racial caricature, which show up in Seuss's work, going right back to his work as a high school student when he wrote a blackface minstrel show and performed in it in blackface, you know, up to the 1950s when he is recycling that in, for example, If I Ran the Zoo. So, yeah, but and then and so he's a complicated character.
I mean, this sounds incredibly complicated, and I definitely think that you're making a compelling argument. I don't mean for this question to sound otherwise, but I also wonder, at the same time, you know, part of what works in children's illustrations and what works on stage are exaggerated facial expressions and characteristics and high contrast, which does happen to be, unfortunately, what black performers had to take on when they were doing these shows. And so I wonder if it's also hard to tease out those similarities from actual, I mean, is that inherently racism? Maybe it is.
I mean, what I would say is that your question, to me at least, suggests a desire to sift out the elements of the work that might be racially complicated and maybe put them aside. And my argument is that we can't do that when we're talking about The Cat in the Hat or children's books and children's culture more generally, that we live in a world in which race matters and which representations of race in culture influence the way we think about it and the way we think about real people. And we can't simply say, well, not this book.
Right. No, completely.
Go ahead.
For you, is this book one that had meant something to you as a child, as the audience for The Cat in the Hat?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have two previous books on Dr. Seuss. I'm a scholar of Seuss, so I've thought a lot about Seuss. And I have great admiration for Seuss, too, I should say. You know, I think he's a great writer of books for children. And he did great anti-racist work too, right? There's the Sneetches, in which the Sneetches with stars on their bellies discriminate against those without. And then at the end of the book, we learn that Sneetches are Sneetches and no kind of Sneetch is the best on the beaches, that they should treat each other equally and fairly. Horton hears a Who. The Whos are discriminated against because of their size, which is an arbitrary mark of difference. And again, we learn a person's a person no matter how small. When that book was published in 1954, the same year as Brown versus Board of Education, one reviewer actually called it a rhymed lesson in protection of minorities and their rights. So Seuss did some really great progressive work, and I admire that. But he also did some work which is not so great. And he also did some work which undermines the progressive work. And so that's what I'm after here. And he's not the only person like that. You know, it's not that someone is like a good person and therefore not racist, or a bad person and then for and therefore racist. It's that a good person or a person who wants to be good is nonetheless influenced in ways that he may not be aware by the culture of which he is a part.
And then when you're in the position of being a children's book author, you are teaching that message over and over and over again.
Yep, exactly. And that's why children's literature is, and children's culture is, the most important place to address racism, because we are not born racist. We learn to be racist. And one of the ways that we learn is through the books we read and the films we watch, the culture we consume. So that's why we ask these questions.
As someone who loves Dr. Seuss enough to have become a Seuss scholar and who has also sort of mined this work to understand hidden racism within it. How emotionally do you cope with these realizations about something you love?
Well, I think all of us need to learn to read uncomfortably. That is to say, it's okay to admire a work of art. It's okay to admire someone's storytelling abilities. But that doesn't mean you have to like everything about it. You know, that doesn't mean that you're prevented from looking at it critically or raising questions about it. Huckleberry Finn is a classic American novel. It's a great American novel. It also treats Jim as less than human.
Jim the slave.
Huck belatedly comes to a realization that Jim is human, but he doesn't necessarily treat him like that. Jim remains a figure of fun and is essentially Huck and Tom's toy in the last third of the book. So, you know, it's a great book. It's also kind of a racist book. And those two things are not incompatible ideas. And I think that's what people need to reckon with.
What about reading those books to children? I mean, you say that we can read uncomfortably. Can we read uncomfortably to another generation?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Children are curious, and you can ask them questions about what you're reading. So if you're reading Roald Dahl's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, in which the Oompa Loompas are these imported people who are happily enslaved in a factory, and thus, you know, presenting us with the idea that there are some kinds of people who really like to be subservient, you can ask children about that. So, you know, what do you think about the Oompa Loompas? Would you like to be shipped from your country to another country in a crate? Would you like to live in a factory and be paid only in beans? Why do you think the book presents that as fun or desirable? I mean, you can have conversations with children, and they'll be unpredictable conversations. They may not go the way you think they're going to go, but that's okay, because you're having a conversation, and you're teaching a child that it's okay to ask questions about what she or he is reading.
You know, have you ever had that experience of having one of those conversations with a child?
Sure. I mean, and that's why I say it can be unpredictable, is that you don't know the direction that it's going to go. It's like teaching. You raise the questions, you start the conversation, but you don't necessarily, you can't predict the outcome. What you can predict is that you're creating this space for critical thinking on the part of a child. And that's good. And that's especially good when encountering racist culture, because I think one of the ways that it damages us is that we don't ask questions about it. But if we do ask questions about it, that can help us. You know, that can help us if we're a child of color and we see racism in a children's book. It can help us, let us know that it's okay to be angry at that, you know, that it's okay to criticize that. And if we're not a child of color, it's helpful also because it makes us aware of racism that we might not have thought about, simply because racism tends to make itself invisible to those who are its beneficiaries, you know, white people.
As our thinking about race continues to evolve, and this is a question for our listeners, what do we do with those beloved old children's books and movies that have a lot to offer, including serious, cringeworthy moments? How do we file that information away? If that's something you've had to reconcile, tell us about how you did it at 816-235-2888. So we've got another guest here in the studio. Let's talk to her. She's a children's book author and parent, Christine Taylor Butler. Hi, Christine.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you? How are you hearing what our other guest has had to share so far?
There's a lot to unpack here. My first comment is the book has some very good things to say about historical perspective on books that I've loved. You know, I was a Cat in the Hat fan when I was growing up, but I had black cats. So I appreciate it because I think as adults we have to go back and look at the origins of some of the treasured books that we loved. I think the problem stems from the fact that we're still teaching those books, and I'm adamant we're chasing the wrong problem. As adults, recognizing that the books have a racist content, the solution that we've been asking for as parents and writers of color is more mainstream concept in which race is not a part of the book at all.
Can you explain that a little more?
Okay. There is a trend because publishing is primarily occupied by white and mostly female editors. I always laugh and say white female editors living in Brooklyn. And they don't understand the cultural nuances or the rhythms, and so they select what they like. And there are a lot of adults in children's publishing who are unpacking their concerns or guilt or thoughts about racism, so that's what they acquire. So if you look at the vast majority of books getting buzz, race is always the central viewpoint of the plot. And we've come back and said one way to defeat racism in children's publishing is books featuring more kids of color, in which race is not the point of view. If I'm running
for student, this is just the person this book is about.
It's a person. If I'm running for student council, I'm doing it because I'm running for student council, not because I'm a black kid running for student council. There is a tendency for editors, and I've had this told to me by colleagues, can you make that name more black so people reading the book will know this is a black kid? And I said, well, you know, my kids' name are Alexis and Olivia. My name's Christine. So what do you want to do? I said, you have to understand there's a range. And maybe racism in Cat in a Hat would be less critical if we had a broader range of books that were not racially related for those kids to read. There's a balance problem that we're having.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I have a one-year-old, and so I'm not yet at the point where we're reading, like, complex plots. But I've noticed that a lot of books that show, like, it'll be just page after page of babies' faces.
Uh-huh.
Or
uh-huh.
There's like a peekaboo book where you lift a flap and behind it there's always a kid and you say peekaboo to each of the kids. And I've noticed that they do show a variety of races of kids in those books, but it's usually like four or five white ones and then like one of everybody else or something. You know what I mean?
Yes, because the tendency is, and an editor who's no longer in the business, and she's white, once told me that her bosses said, can't you just throw in a black character? Or there was a famous author who had submitted a book, and can't you change one of those characters to black and or Hispanic or Asian? And I said, that's not fixing the problem. The problem is, if I have a kid who was part of Debate KC, that's an oxymoron. You know, you have a kid who speaks Latin and debates because they're not shown in books. They're only shown if they're trying to get shoes or if the utilities aren't on or a cop has just shot a friend. And, you know, I'm a writer, and so I believe write your truth. But I'm a mother, and I'm saying I'm really sick of it, really sick of it. And if we're going to talk about Cat in the Hat and, you know, Willy Wonka, we need 100 other joyful books to balance that out.
Well, we have to take a short break, but when we come back, we want to hear from you. Have you gone back to any of your favorite children's books only to see something that makes you cringe? Can you go on appreciating the beauty in a story even while recognizing that messages about race or gender are questionable at best? 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking to K-State's Philip Nell, who's written a book about the hidden racism in classic children's literature, starting with The Cat in the Hat. We're also joined by a children's book author and parent, Christine Taylor Butler. Hi again, Christine.
Hi.
And hi again to you, Philip.
Hello.
So you can call 816-235-2888 to tell us how you have wrestled with race in children's literature, and especially if you've discovered that it exists in some of your own favorite children's books. We want to know if that felt so challenging to you that it ruined everything, or if you were able to separate a problematic character or illustration from what you've always loved. We're going to, now, Philip, what do you think about what Christine has been telling us?
I agree with everything that she said. I think she's absolutely right. In 2016, there were 22% of books published, children's books, that were about people of color, and only 12% actually written by people of color,
whereas
school-age children, 50% of school-age children right now are non-white children. And that's a huge gap between the kinds of books being created and the kids reading them. So, yeah, everything that she said is correct, and certainly one way to fight racism is to have books, as she suggests, where race is incidental. It's not the central theme of the book. One of my favorite such books is called One Word from Sophia, about a bright girl named Sophia who wants a giraffe, and it is delightful, and it is funny, and her race is not the point. So yes, yes to everything she said.
Ah, oh, thank you.
No, thank you. You put it very well, so thank you.
It's true that creating new children's literature is part of this equation. It's also true that parents and maybe even teachers love going back to mm-hmm. these sort of nostalgic things from their own youth and sharing those with their children. And so revisiting this idea of what do you do with those old favorites when you look at them with maybe a more critical eye as a grown-up. I mean, Christine, have you ever had this experience of looking back at a children's favorite and seeing it differently?
Little Black Sambo, which I read a lot when I was a kid. You know, my daughter's surprised to find out I was born before the Civil Rights Act. Yeah, you go back and you see things with a different eye as an adult. But here's my issue. That's a lot to unpack on a kid, and kids are a lot more resilient than we are. So the question that I have is, rather than regurgitating our favorite classics on kids, especially if they are problematic, now that we're being educated, where are the new classics? Where are the things they are going to teach their own children? There are a lot of books being produced by authors of color. They get no marketing. They're dead in a year. The books produced for children of color by white authors get a lot of marketing. They get toured to book festivals. And hence, that's why you have the statistics that you have, which is 22%, which is too low. But the vast majority of them are written by people who are not of the race of the character in the book. So that's why I said sometimes we're chasing the wrong solution to this identified problem.
And so you're saying that the solution is more representation of authors of color and more, characters of color, not in a racialized plot.
More authors of color, more editors of color who understand the cultural rhythms better and don't have to have a translator. But also, let's create new classics. Let's create better classics. Let's recognize people like Philip mentioned Just Us Books. They were on the forefront of trying to create culturally relevant literature, and they're still around. But they are kind of drowned out by the Random Houses and the Penguin Putnams and the Scholastics. And so what we should do is go find the people who are doing it right. And let's celebrate them. Use those as a model.
As a children's book author yourself, I mean, do you feel like you've got lots... I think like when you're doing something with a lot of awareness, you can often have that feeling of lots of voices kind of whispering in your ear, telling you what it's important to achieve, which I think makes it very hard sometimes to
yes.
not feel paralyzed or like you can just tell a story without second guessing the message. Do you struggle with that?
I do. And there are colleagues who are thinking about dropping out of the business. I call children's publishing lately the kid-lit version of Hunger Games. You know, we have bloggers who will call out things that they don't like. I think we've set some dangerous precedents with social media. So we can't afford to have people second-guessing their writing. This is not a scholarly assignment for college grade. You know, we're trying to write for kids, and we're trying to write our truths, and you're going to get it wrong. But do your best.
Let's talk to Jerry. Jerry's calling us from Kansas City. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Glad to speak with you.
What can you share?
Well, I just spoke with one of your representatives there, and I thought, well, go ahead and call in, because I wanted to let you know that from the time my children were very, very young, even babies, I always read to them and point out pictures and just kind of talk about what the little story was about. And as they grew up, we did the same thing. And whenever we would come, I read the classics to my kids. And when we'd come to the stories that were a little bit difficult to talk about, I did, and I'd ask them questions, and this is before they even went to school, and they would give their little opinions on what we were talking about, and I think that's very, very important. The other thing that I wanted to say, it's not hard. My babies were all born, and they're all grown now, 50s and 40s, and, you know. So they grew up at a time when all kinds of things were happening. But we went ahead and discussed, and I would buy them books. It wasn't hard to find quality books for children, no matter what age they were, about that address, the different races. So
you appreciated books that addressed race head on.
Oh, I always have. Books, dolls, anything.
Well, thanks, Jerry.
Anything. And one thing, we grew up in a military family. We grew up in a military family. My husband and I both are military. We're older now, but the children grew up that way. So race wasn't a big issue at all. They had friends, neighbors of all nationalities.
Well,
and our children are the same way now that they're grown.
Yeah, thank you, Jerry.
Grew up that way, so it makes a big difference.
You know,
thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Something that I hear, I mean, a couple of things in these comments. One is that maybe if real life represents positive messages, maybe that gives you a little more mm-hmm. flexibility in your mm-hmm. children's books. Like if your kids are encountering other people of many races in a really positive way, I don't know, does the world that our kids are otherwise growing up in part of the issue here? I'm going to start with you, Philip.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Brown versus Board of Education allegedly ended school segregation, but it didn't end school segregation. Children today grew up in a very segregated world, and they don't encounter people of different races a lot, and that's a problem.
It puts a lot of pressure on children's books.
It puts a lot of pressure on children's books. Racism is structural, and to address it, you have to address the structures, one of which is segregation, another of which is the children's book publishing industry, as Christina was saying. I mean, it's mostly white, mm-hmm. And that means mostly white stories get published. So, yeah, I mean, we need to change society structurally in order to address racism effectively, and that's hard, but it's also necessary, and that's what we have to do.
Christine?
Well, yeah, you know, I go back to this issue of, I have discussions with my kids, but I'll give you a non-kid lit example. I have a husband who works at the hospital. I was reading House of God and laughing and going, oh my God, you should read this. And he says, why would I want to read a book about my experiences every day?
You know, and what is House of God about?
House of God is about interns going through an internship and all the disasters that happen in a hospital. You know, he wouldn't watch ER. He wouldn't watch Grey's Anatomy. He says, that's my life. It's the same thing going on with black kids. You know, black kids need a range. Hispanic and Asian kids need a range. If everything is about an ethically specific topic and it's because it's of interest to the editor that acquired it,
an editor who might be carrying some racial guilt and so forth.
Yeah, and they try, but at a certain point in time, if you don't speak French, you can't represent France. You know, you can't just look at a TV show and say, oh, I got it. I saw a black person walking down the street and I watched 3 episodes on BET. I'm going to do this black. What we end up with black characters that don't resonate with their target audience because they sound like a white woman from Brooklyn.
Let's talk to Mike calling us from Kansas City. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What can you share?
Well, I was just interested in revisiting children's books that I had read. I'm half Japanese and grew up in Japan. And the book that I remember is a book called Japanese Children's Favorite Stories. And even rereading that book, I don't feel any of the divisions of race that you and your guests have spoken about. But I also understand that half of my culture are the most racist people on the planet. And in Japan, in Japanese culture, you are either Japanese or not. And so there wouldn't be, I guess, any racism in their books because they're assuming you're Japanese.
Can you give an example just from this book of something that you view that way when you think back on it or look back at it?
View which way?
where you become aware of this issue of the assumption of the reader being Japanese or being one of us or not one of us.
Oh, well, that's the thing about the book. You don't pick that up in the book. It's something you have to bring to the book. If you just pick up the book, no matter where you're from, they're just lovely stories. Stories of fantasy and mythological things that are part of Japanese culture. You know, teaching you things about kindness and sharing and all the things that children's books, I think, are supposed to teach children. There's a story about an old couple. It's a winter scene, and they're coming back to their house, and they notice that all these statues are standing out in the cold, and so they kindly take off, you know, their hat and their coat and all this and share it with the statues and go back to the little house. Well, it's a poor farm family, and the next morning they wake up, and there are all these rice cakes and other things at their front steps, and they notice that there are prints in the snow, and they're round prints made by the statues as they brought these gifts to these people for their kindness. And so that's the story. You learn about kindness, and you learn about sharing, and in this case it's between statues and old farm people.
Well, thanks for that call, Mike. I mean, we've been treating this in the American context. Mm-hmm. I wonder, mm-hmm. Philip, as a scholar, do you have international context on this?
Well, it sounds to me, if I'm understanding Mike correctly, that Japanese-ness works in a bit the way that whiteness works in children's literature, that it has a tendency to make itself invisible. There's kind of an assumption of whiteness, you know, mm-hmm. For example, in American children's literature, let's say whiteness comes to stand for humankind rather than a white person.
Right.
And it sounds like in the Japanese children's books, something similar is happening. That's my understanding of what Mike is saying.
Let's talk to Pete, who's calling from near KCI. Hi, Pete.
Hey, Gina. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Is this Pete reading Reptile Pete?
Maybe. It could be, but you don't know.
Hi, Pete.
All right. We'll never know.
I had a question for you, sort of.
Okay, go.
I'm kind of troubled by the discussion of creating a publishing landscape where characters' race is incidental. I find that problematic, honestly. We live in one of the most racially charged periods of my adult lifetime, and to not write literature addressing race. I totally agree that the publishing industry is a backwater in terms of progressive, you know, thinking. But I certainly don't think we want to create a world, an antiseptic world that that doesn't reflect the world I live in. So that's really, I'm going to leave it there for you guys to talk about.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
Hey, Pete. Yeah. The biggest issue here is not sanitizing. It is, you know, Philip makes a really good point about what happened when the Coretta Scott King Awards happened, is that it became a litmus test for what publishers would acquire: slavery, civil rights, race-based angst. You know, they're all trying to unpack things, but it's ethnic kids that get all the unpacking. And what we're saying is not to have a sanitized world, but why is it every time we've got an ethnic character, it's a race-based angst? That's the issue.
Yeah, can I add to what Christine is saying in agreement, which is we absolutely need books about history. We need realistic fiction. We need books that teach children about the racist history of this country. The problem is that if you're a writer of color, often those are the only kind of books that
you can get published.
You can get published. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, thank you both so much. I'm sorry, okay. We've got to jog out of here, but Philip Nell, Christine Taylor Butler, thank you both so much for joining this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can keep it going on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Up next, a local writer and activist with her new book of poems on KCUR's Central Standard. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and our next guest is Jessica Ayala, who's here with her new book of poetry. It's called Welga. And Jessica, A, I hope I pronounced that semi-decently, and B, what does it mean?
You did wonderful. Ayala and Huelga. Huelga is a Spanish word that is very, very popular in our community. Our wonderful leaders, Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, began that word as a movement in our community during the migrant farm worker movement to strike against picking grapes and selling grapes until there was equal wage payment for immigrants.
You know, you have an entire poem in this book dedicated to the meaning of that word, both the literal meaning and its larger meaning, which you've just hinted at. But I was interested in looking at some of the English words that you listed next to it, things indicating both resistance, but also a pause or interruption.
That's correct. Huelga can mean several. I believe that lots of Spanish words can mean several meanings. This word is a literal meaning word, but it's also a spiritual one. It's a movement. So it means to gather a community to say, you know what, we need to stop and we need to withhold and we need to strike and boycott and come to a place where we're resisting together. Huelga.
So talk to me about this book and what inspired you to want to write not just a book of poems, but a book of poems under that title.
Of course. The title of the book didn't come to me until I was finished with the manuscript. It seems most of my creative process has happened that way. I just begin to inspire what I know is authentic, and I create until I'm finished with a piece of work, and then I look at it and I say, okay, I have this entire collection of poems that I have written in a 10-year time span, and I'm looking at them, and they're about the movement, and they're about organizing, and about our resistance, and our children, and how brave they are. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm sitting here, and my mother is telling me about church members who are afraid in our community at this time.
When you say our community, what are you
talking
about?
The Latino community, the immigrant community, the Spanish-speaking community, the undocumented community. So she's sharing with me these stories of families who are afraid. I'm hearing all over social media, you know, folks saying, be careful, don't take this route or don't get on this highway. And it frustrated me so much that I thought this is the most perfect time for me to title this book Huelga, because even though I was doing this work 10 to 15 years ago, we're still here.
You write in sort of, I guess you could call it an introductory poem in the book. You write, the resistance also looks like 6-inch heels, red ruby lipstick, and a notebook. What are you saying there?
That's my favorite line.
It jumped out at me.
Well, I am a lover of jazz. Big shout outs to 18th and Vine and the Mutual Musicians Foundation. I wrote this manuscript between the hours of, I want to say, 1:30 and 5 o'clock in the morning at the Mutual Musicians Foundation several weekends. It's where I go to think, but it's also the place where I love to put on lipstick and, you know, put my heels on and
which doesn't mean you're not thinking.
That's correct. So, you know, resistance means that we don't have to be on the streets, you know, shouting, although that there's nothing wrong with that, you know, there's joy in resistance. And we can still put on lipstick in the resistance, and we can still put on 6-inch heels in the resistance, because that's what we have inside of our hearts. So I love it, because you're absolutely right. It is one of my favorite poems.
There's a poem in this book that makes me wonder if you are a teacher, if that's part of your experience. I mean, actually, a couple of poems in this book make me wonder that.
Yes, absolutely. I was in education for about 9 years. I worked for the Hickman Mills School District and then went over to Crossroads Academy of Kansas City downtown.
I'd like you to read a poem called English as a Second Language. It's a little bit of a longer poem, but I think it tells a story, and I want us to hear it.
Absolutely. This poem is called English as a Second Language. Apple. Boy, cat. English as a second language, my tongue twists from right to left as I imitate this foreign dialect. English as a second language, English as my second slave tongue, my first. Spanish. Conquest. Colonize. Criminalize. When two vowels go walking, the first one does the talking. I tell Jose as he cries to me, I cannot read. My poor baby is losing his identity. He cannot read in English. He cannot speak in Spanish. Jose stands 3 feet tall with his head hung low. Every teacher who has taught him has quit him, has said no. Just like our gobernador, just like our neighborhoods. Hola, Jose. Mi nombre es Jessica. We're going to start our first session with a simple lesson called oppression. Rabbit. Raid. Racism. English as a second language, my tongue twists from right to left as I imitate this foreign dialect. I'm an immigrant. Ni soy de aquí, ni soy de allá. I was born in la tierra de Colombia. Is it worth it to stay here? To leave the brown skin that loves me? To leave behind all of our families? To chase the American dream because our children are going hungry? No, I would rather go hungry in Mexico and in El Salvador. I would rather go hungry than to be eaten alive by Missouri's gobernador. Immigrant. Invisible. Illegal. It is illegal to colonize me. It is illegal to criminalize me. It is illegal to enslave me by moving me to a new reservation called deportation. English as a second language, my tongue twists from right to left as I imitate this foreign dialect.
How do writing and activism work together for you? Because it sounds to me like they do.
Yes. You know, I was not expecting or planning on showing up in the world like this.
What do you mean?
Well, as a writer, I have always written poetry. I've always kept napkins and receipts in shoeboxes. And folks always said, well, when are you going to do this? When are you going to finally publish, you know, your poems? When are you going to continue to perform? And I thought, you know, I didn't see it as something that I would submerge myself into. I just thought it was just something I did, you know, when people invited me to come to certain events. The work was important to me, and that's what I was focused on, is making sure that, you know, our families, our undocumented families, our Spanish-speaking and Latino families had the services and the equality that they needed. But, you know, through that time span, something happened to me, and I feel like I had kind of like a midlife crisis because I wasn't passionate about getting up anymore to serve, and it scared me.
As an activist?
As an activist. I really couldn't get up anymore and help anybody anymore. And I had to take some time away because I didn't know who I was anymore. And so what I did was, is I put on lipstick, I put on 6-inch heels, I went to see my friends play jazz, and I started writing. And this is what happened. And this is how I'm showing up in the world today.
You came to the United States, I've heard, as a small child who took a little while to learn English, and that you are using language now as your primary tool is so fascinating to me. Also, just that your poems are not, to say that this is a bilingual book of poems might be misleading, because only in one case is there a poem in English, then translation of that poem in Spanish.
That's right.
For the most part, they just flow back and forth between the two languages. Who's your audience?
You know, when I sat down to write, I just wrote my experiences. I wrote down what I have been witnessing and seeing in my own community and the pain that I have felt, you know, in quiet spaces where, you know, you can't really tell anybody anything, you know, after a protesting or lobbying in Jefferson City and you know, seeing people get deported and, you know, having to tell your youth that you can't go to college. So, it, you know...
What do you mean by you can't tell anybody anything?
Well, I mean, when you're in the role that I used to play, you know, as an activist or as a leader, you know, people, you know, they look at you as a source of strength, and so when you break, they don't know what to do sometimes, and so you know, or at least that's the perception. You know, I think I've grown, you know, as a person since then, but I really felt like I needed to keep all of that quiet. So the way that I did it, private, more importantly, just private and sacred. I felt like it was just a time that I needed to pray about with great spirit and to write about. So when I wrote the poetry, I wrote it just so that I can get a lot of the emotions and the pain that I was experiencing on the road as a community organizer out. And when I started putting the collection together in my manuscript, I realized, you know, this isn't just me getting this out. This is about an entire community that I've absolutely loved and had the honor to serve. So that's my audience.
You asked in the poem we just heard whether it's worth it to you to stay here.
Uh-huh.
Is that a question you find yourself asking?
All the time. I always think of my father when I ask that question because, you know, my father has never been one. He wants to go home. I mean, he's going to retire soon and go home and build a life in Colombia. You know, he immigrated to the United States for my mother and her dreams and the dreams of his children. I just see my father so much happier in my own country and a completely different person. But I experience that with a lot of immigrants who go back to their homes and they're just their natural origin. I think about it all the time. You know, however, being a bilingual child and being of both worlds, being Colombian American, over the years, you know, you begin to embrace and love who you are because I'm both American and I'm Colombian. And when I'm in Colombia, I miss America, and when I'm here, I miss Colombia. So it's ni soy de aquí, ni soy de allá.
Neither here nor there.
That's correct.
You have a poem called Si Se Puede, which people will remember as part of Barack Obama's presidential campaign, a phrase that held a lot of currency at that point. And there's a phrase in that poem in Spanish, and my Spanish accent is terrible, but it's aquí no ha cambiado nada.
That's right.
And which means here nothing has changed.
That's right.
What do you mean by that? That seems like it could have many different meanings.
Absolutely. That poem was specifically directed towards my undocumented community and the community who lives in fear and lives in the shadows. Nothing has stopped here. You know, we still remain a strong people. We still remain a people who have dreams and have aspirations and have joy. You know, because of our current political status, nothing changes. You know, we're still resilient. We're still brave. You know, we're still getting up. We still have dreams. Our kids are still going to school. You know, we still have dreams to open up a small business or send money home, you know, so that you can help your mother build a home. So that's what the poem is about. It's just saying nothing has stopped. Nothing has changed. You know, just because our political climate has changed, nothing has changed for us. Our spirits still remain as resilient and as brave and as courageous as they've ever been.
In the poem I had you read, it was about ostensibly about teaching someone English,
mm-hmm.
whose first language is Spanish. Can you take me back to that experience for yourself?
You're going to make me cry. Well, I had a young man. He was in the fourth grade. His name was Jose. And I would push in to the classrooms in our ESL program. And my main job was to pull him aside or sometimes sit next to him and just really assist him in whatever, you know, he needed as far as language was concerned. But I noticed that he was so uncomfortable when I would come in because he was the only brown, you know, baby in the room. And I know what that feels like. So I used to say, you know, Jose, how do you feel about just coming to my classroom? And you can walk by yourself. So you're a big fourth grader now. You can just do that. We can do this in private. And that's where that exchange happened. I mean, he cried to me. And he said, I don't know how to read. And I don't know how to speak in Spanish. And I thought, oh, my gosh, like, you cannot communicate with your parents. You really can't. And you really can't engage or participate with your other peers. You know, so you are just on this island. And I said, you know what? That's okay, because I experienced the same. You know, I didn't have anybody like myself growing up. So we're going to do this together, and we're going to take as much time as we need to, and we're going to make this happen for you.
When you didn't have that growing up, I mean, can you describe that just a little more before we go?
I mean, I relied solely on my eyes and my ears to listen to tones and facial expressions. I mean, a lot of my friends who graduated with me at Truman Elementary in the Hickman Mill School District can relate with that. I mean, they would grab me by the hand and say, come on, Jessica, it's time for recess. Or no, you can't, you only pick up one. And so hand gestures, eye expressions, tones, until I began to recognize what the sound of the language, which is English, is about.
Well, Jessica Ayala, thank you for stopping by
thank
and
you.
Talking with me today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Jessica's new book is Huelga. It's a book of poems, and she's got a reading and book launch this Saturday, August 26th at Prospero's on 39th Street. So if you want to hear more, check that out. Our time is up, but thanks to everyone who joined this morning's conversations. You can listen back to all of it at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow, is the Northland angling to become the new Midtown? And why does that part of town vote so strongly against streetcar expansion? We'll find out tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman.